Welcome to Season 6 of Game Design Unboxed on the No Direction Network. Danielle Reynolds talks to tabletop game designers about the games they've made. Together, they unbox how the game went from inspiration to publication.
This season is proudly sponsored by AllPlay. As I mentioned before the last episode, AllPlay has their new Sail Legacy come to Kickstarter. It's a two-player, co-op, trick-taking game with lots of legacy mechanics that is based on the original Sail's clever trick-taking gameplay, where the combinations of symbols on the cards help navigate the ship. Now, you get to explore over 30 missions that you actually get to return to after the legacy campaign ends, meaning you're not throwing your game away. So go check out this campaign on Kickstarter, as well as AllPlay's other games, bags, tables, and more. Thank you for joining me, Danielle, for Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 113, Resistor. Today we are joined by Nicole Amato, designer of Resistor, Laser Riders, and the current games outreach lead at Kickstarter. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited.
I'm super pumped to talk about this game and just what got you into gaming. For anyone who doesn't know you, would you mind telling them how you started designing games?
Wildly, I got started in 2009 writing about video games. That was my foray into the gaming world. I started doing video games journalism. I was living in Philadelphia at the time, and I got involved with the local Philadelphia game developer group. They had a weekly meetup called Philly Dev Night, which was so much fun, and they would have monthly game jams. I was with my late husband, Anthony Amato. Anthony and I met in 2011 playing Dungeons & Dragons, to give you an idea of kind of
cute.
People. Yeah. We met playing Dungeons & Dragons at a board game store his friends owned, and that's actually where we ended up getting married, was at the same board game store, which was really cute. We just got really into board games, and I had always loved board games. I had, had that family where we had, board game night, and they were all intensely competitive. I had been playing board games for a long time, and Anthony and I just got really into board games. We loved Pandemic. There were a bunch of games that we found that we loved playing together because they were good for two players, and we were both late night people. So we were what games can we play together at 1 o'clock in the morning? And there was a game jam. We were you know what? We're going to do the next game jam. We're just going to make a tabletop game. We're going to make a board game. We can do that. We were on our way to Dev Night, and I texted my friend Jackie, because Anthony said, hey, what's the theme for the jam? And I said, let me text Jackie. And Jackie replied, pick an Oasis song title and make a game out of it. And everybody infamously knew that Anthony hated the band Oasis.
Ouch.
So he thought I was kidding. He was like, no, what's the actual theme? And I was like, no, I'm pretty sure that's... And I double checked with Jackie. I was like, is this a joke? And she was like, nope. And Will, who ran Dev Night, was like, no, I came up with that for Anthony. That was just for Anthony. I strongly recommend looking at the list of Oasis song titles because they are absolutely wild. And once you take a look at it, you won't be surprised to know that multiple people made a game off of the song title Fucking in the Bushes, which I think is hilarious. But we chose, I think the song title was Roll It Over. That was how we made Resistor. It was with index cards, and at first it was just with single and double lines, so you had to connect single lines across or connect double lines across, and all of the index card pieces were double-sided, and that was how it started. We were pretty excited about it, and then it was a 1 week jam. So you started it at Dev Night and then you took it home and finished it and then came back a week later and they had a judging, and we won. We won the jam, and it was in 2013. So the prize that we won was an Ouya. Do you remember the Ouya?
The what now?
It's Ouya, and it was an Android based gaming console.
Oh, that's where you lost me. Android based. Okay.
And it was just hilarious because we were whoa, maybe we actually can do this. And that was how it all started.
That's so fun. Okay, so then for people that don't know how to play, how do you play Resistor? I know you kind of talked about lines on cards, double-sided, but what exactly are you doing?
Yeah, so now the final version there's red lines and blue lines. So one player is the red player, one player is the blue player, and you're supercomputers trying to blow each other up. So the board is made up of a set number of cards. I cannot believe, I can't remember how many it is. I want to say it is 7, 5. I really should have looked up the game. And
it's okay, it's been a bit.
Yeah, so all the cards are double-sided, and you're each holding two cards in your hands. So you can either, on your turn, you can use cards from your opponent's hand, or you can use cards from your own hand. And honestly, it's really just a hand of four cards shared between us, but there's something really satisfying about taking the card out of your opponent's hand. You also flip a card, you replace a card on the board, And basically, you're just trying to set up the line so that if you're the red player, you have a red line going all the way across. And if you're the blue player, you have a blue line going all the way across. But some of the cards also have, some of the cards have red and blue lines on them, and some of them have resistors on them. And the resistors do special things. So it's partially a memory game. One of the wildest things to me was someone said to me when we were running a demo, they were like, well, what happens if I memorize the card? And I was like, then you got your $25 worth out of this game, because I've play tested this game like over 1,000 times, and I've yet to do it. And when we went to print, like right as we were about to go to print, I said to Anthony, hey, I need you to change these three cards. And he said, why? And I said, because I memorized them. They were just unique enough that every time I saw one side of those cards, I knew what was going to be on the other side.
Interesting. So it's like you could hate draft?
You can't hate draft, but you can, like, if I saw that card in my opponent's hand or in my own hand, I knew the side that they could see.
Yeah.
So I could set it up in a way that felt unfair because I played the game so many times.
Gotcha. That's really cool. I like the idea of like being able to see the backside and that having a different piece of information, you can use it.
The biggest challenge of being able to use both sides of the card was that we had to have a box, like a deck box that stood up straight so that when you pulled it out of the box, you couldn't see the other side. And that was the challenge that we brought to both like friends who understood manufacturing and also friends who owned board game stores. Because we were like, hey, these are some of the ideas that we have for what the box could look like. How do you feel about having this on your store shelf? And our friend Adam, whose board game store we met at, he was instrumental in us creating that box design because he was like one of the early favorite ones we had. He was like, I would be furious with you if you made me put this on my store shelf.
Oh, interesting. I was looking at pictures before we started talking of the box and how it kind of like comes up from the middle. And I was like, that's really cool for, not to say like that time, because this game, I know it's been out for quite a bit, but I'm trying to think of like other games that have a similar, like you can pull from one side or the other and it only sees like the one side. But I don't know, it looks cool.
I feel like a bunch of people made games with that idea after we made that, because we made it in 2013. The Kickstarter was early 2015. And I know at least one person who was like, hey, I'm stealing that idea for my game. And I was like, good.
You're like, yeah, I'm gonna start a revolution.
Yeah, I loved it. I loved that people were using it.
Oh, that's super duper cool. And are you a fan of like two-player games?
At the time, I was thrilled because there were like so few games that play at two players are different than games that are playable at two players, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, totally. Totally makes sense.
Like, there are so many games that we would get them, we'd be like, oh, it says it plays at two. And then we'd be like, oh, there's a two-player variant that doesn't work very well. So one of our favorite games was Jaipur. And I just absolutely loved that game. But also, you know, one of the challenging things was we self-published and we had other two-player games that were very, we would pitch them to publishers and publishers would always say to us, we need you to make this playable at 3 to 4 players. And it's like, well, that sounds like the opposite thing that we hate, right? You're taking a two-player game and you're just making a play at 3 or 4, but not necessarily playable. And there was one game that we made that we pitched to publishers and we had one publisher say, hey, we'd love to publish this, but you'd have to make it playable. And we spent 6 months, we fixed it, we made it actually playable and fun at 3 to 4 players. And then the pandemic happened. They passed on it. And what's hilarious is that I feel like two players since the pandemic are having a renaissance. That's exactly what, yeah, I was going to say. Like Josh, my fiance, and I just got Quacks of Quedlinburg, the Duel. We've only played it once and I don't know if I love it, but I love the original Quacks so much that I want to give it a few more tries. The Splendor Duel game is like awesome. I love it.
I agree. I had like one of the first copies you could get. I like waited in line at Essen. And
that's amazing.
Yeah, I'm glad that that one was worth the wait. I was curious about Quacks, so that's good to know. I won't buy it. I'll try it before I buy it.
Here's the thing. We played it, and when we first started playing it, when I understood how the game functioned, I was like, this is going to take forever. Like, just the way that the win condition works, I was like, oh, this is going to take forever. And Josh was like, oh, but also if we've run out of the deck of cards, so after like 7 rounds or whatever, the game's also over. I was like, okay, that's way more tolerable. And then we got to the last round, and I swear, it was like so much excitement in the last round. It was anybody's game in the last round, and it felt like the whole game was the last round. So I was like, man, I think we got to play this again just to see. I don't know. I'm definitely interested to hear your opinion of it when you play it, so please let me know when you play it.
Yeah, because Quacks of Quedlinburg is still like probably in my top 5 games.
Oh, God, it's so fun.
It's just like one of those games that I could introduce my non-gamer friends to, where like, yes, it takes a hot sec for me to teach it, but after that, they enjoy it.
It's just delightful. And I have the Board Game Geek geek up bits, and like, they're so tactile, and like, ugh, I wish they had them for Quacks the Duel, because I'm like, I need that upgrade.
You need it to be a little bit nicer. Look, I need that date night expansion. Could you make this nicer? Oh, that's so funny. No, I feel you though with it being like this two-player renaissance, because I've been trying to make more two-player games because of the fact that I bought too many back in the day when I had a partner and I was like, oh, we're gonna play this. And I was like, oh, this is not a good game. But then I played in a group. I'm like, wait, this is a great game. What the hell? I prefer when publishers decide to put like 3 to 4 player on it, and then like it'll say plus on the back, like in the writing, a two-player variant versus saying 2 to 4 player. I think that's more like realistic. You should do the player count that will make your game shine so you don't have people poo-pooing on it.
I mean, what's wild to me is I feel like there's also been a huge, I don't even want to say renaissance, surge in people who want a solo variant of every game.
Oh, yeah.
And like those, like that I understand, hey, we made a solo variant, that being like a thing that they have to mention or that is different and like requires, like, you know, there's going to be an AI part of the deck or whatever, but like two player versions, like, I agree with you, they should say like there is a variant, not this plays 2 to 4.
Oh yeah, if you're going to be running another person's like hand or deck or doing some kind of form of AI to run the character, that means it's not actually a two-player game. It's basically the same concept as a solo game.
Yeah, exactly.
That does bother me. That is a pet peeve. Completely agree there. Because I mean, at the time when you had your game going, there weren't as many two players. You decided to self-publish this. Like, at what point did you decide to do that? And what path did you take?
That is such a wild part of the story, too. By the time we made the game, I knew, like, a lot of people in the video game industry. Like, I had been doing, you know, video game journalism for, like, 4 years. So I had been going to PAX East. I had been going to PAX West. I was very I had been to, like, E3. I was familiar with the video game circuit. But I had never done the board game part of that. So once we made a board game, we just started embracing the board game side of it. So like, I talked to Jason Tagmeyer, I went to high school with Jason Tagmeyer, which is such a wild story. I remember going to like one of my first IGDA meetings and I was like, what are you doing here? And he was like, what are you doing here? And I was like, I don't know, actually. he gave us so much great advice. And then we kind of just took everybody's advice and just started going to like as many board game events as possible. We went to our first Unpub. We went to our first Gen Con. I think we might have gone to Origins. No, not that year. But we just went to as many events as possible. And we had convinced ourselves, like, we had been using Kickstarter for years at that point to back, you know, other people's games. And we were like, oh, I guess we have to use Kickstarter because we're brand new. You know, nobody would want to publish us. And that's what we said to everybody. Like, we were just like, oh, we're going to Kickstarter. Like, do you have any like advice or feedback? And like, people were like paying it forward and giving us all this great advice and stuff. And then what's funny was we ran our Kickstarter and we funded in like the first like 60 hours or I don't remember. We decided to run our Kickstarter and start it the week of PAX East. So we were like, okay, we'll run the Kickstarter and then we'll go to PAX East and we're in Indie Mega Booth and we'll have like a little QR code and people can back the game and, you know, it'll be so cool. And then we funded and there was a giant snowstorm and we were scrambling to get ready because we were taking the bus from Philly to Boston. We were like, we're going to try to catch an earlier bus. And Anthony did all of the art and graphic design for the game. So he's like frantically like making a Kickstarter update before we get on this bus while I'm like packing our bags. And Level 99 ended up being interested in it and asking us if we wanted to be a part, like if we would be willing to like make a publishing deal with them because they had a bunch of games that were the same size as us. So they were like, it could be like in our like set that we have of these games that are this size. And it was wild because we already had like everything set up. We had like a printer set up. The art was done. The rule book was done. We had everything finished. And so, you know, for Level 99 to come in, we were just like, this is an option. And we talked to a bunch of friends. I remember we had a call that week with Tagmeyer. We had a call that week with Chris Kirkman. We had a call with somebody else. I can't remember who it was. And we were just like, have you guys ever like heard of this before? And it was funny because I think it was Kirkman was like, well, I would have been excited to like publish your game, but you were just so set on Kickstarter. And we were like, oh no, we hurt ourselves.
Our enthusiasm, damn us.
Yeah, we didn't realize we had even a shot at getting a publisher's. But it was great because I immediately was like, Anthony was so funny because I immediately was like, I just want to make sure the contract says, like, nothing gets shipped to us. Like, everything gets shipped directly to Level 99. Like, we don't have to have, like, 1,000 copies of the game in our house.
We don't do logistics.
Yeah. So that was great. And, like, Brad was awesome to work with. You know, he went over the rule book. He playtested a bunch. He jumped right in. He was awesome. He brought us to, like, a bunch of shows with him. We went to our first BGG con. And it was great. I really liked working with him. We didn't realize that we messed up our own chances because we didn't realize that Kickstarter was like a dirty word at that time. You know what I mean?
I feel like I don't. What do you mean by dirty word? Just like...
Yeah, like publishers at that time were like, well, why would I want to publish you if you want to go to Kickstarter? You're going to cannibalize my audience. Like they looked at it as like, oh, if you get 1,000 sales on Kickstarter, then that's 1,000 sales that I won't get. So how can I, like, it wasn't used so much as a, like, a predictor of how many copies you were going to sell so much as it was like, well, that's your whole, that's all the games you're going to sell. So why would I, you know what I mean?
Oh, gotcha. Okay. So yeah.
It's definitely changed. It's the view has definitely changed. But like at the time, like 12 years ago, it was very much, I didn't think a lot of people would even consider, because that was the feedback that we got from a lot of publishers was like, why would I want to do that? And we were like, that's reasonable. God, what a long time ago. What a weird time that was. Yeah.
Yeah, because now when I think of Kickstarter, I think of it as either a way to predict how popular a game could be or to use it as a form of marketing for your game or pre-ordering for a game, or like still how it was initially intended for independent creators who can't afford an initial print run without that money. So it's just like so interesting.
Yeah, now it's for sure an amalgam of like bigger companies and even medium-sized companies doing forecasting and then small companies being like, well, I just want to make like, I don't know, 500 copies of this. And then I'm good.
They do want to use it the way that they were all assuming.
Yeah.
Like, I don't want to work out how logistics works. I just want to print the copies that got bought and then some might end up in a library. I don't know.
Exactly.
Did they end up having any changes like Level 99 when they did some playtesting?
No, I don't think they changed anything at all. I think they were really pleasantly surprised. One thing that we did mess up though was, and this is part of why I always caution, this is like an example I use to people when they ask me like what they should do for stretch goals. Like we had like cards that we added to the game that were stretch goals that we had play tested, but we didn't add them to the rule book. And I was like, oh no, like I didn't find out that we forgot to add them to the rule book until after we had shipped. And somebody was like, how do these cards work? And I was like, oh God, just go to page. And then I went in the rule book and I was like, no, you can't go to any page because it's not in the rule book. And I was just like, oh, we dunked. Oh, no. We dunked it. Yeah. So that's why I always tell people, like, hey, if you're thinking about, like, doing stretch goals, keep in mind, like, you got to put the stuff in the rule book. It has to be totally playtested. The art has to be done.
Oh, did you end up putting it on, like, a website or something for people to find?
I think I might have made an FAQ on BGG or I don't remember what I did. Mostly I was embarrassed.
Learning opportunity.
Exactly.
That's so funny. And when you were working on the game in general, were there any things that like through development or playtesting you guys ended up tweaking before it went to Level 99 in Kickstarter?
I mean, the really wild thing about Resistor was that like we made it on the index cards and then we made it with like, we added color to it. And then it was just so, the biggest thing that we changed was adding in the resistors. And then once we added the resistors, the game's just missing like something like, what is it missing? We're like, oh, what if it has this like extra element that can like heal you? It just gave the game the one extra level of complexity that it was missing. And then after that, we kind of didn't really tweak it after that. We sort of just, you know, Anthony was a perfectionist with art. I'll tell you right now, one of the most difficult things that we ended up having was Anthony was so good at art and loved doing art for our games to the point that publishers would be like, no, I don't even want to look at this game because it's obvious that you've already put a lot of time and effort into this art and I would retheme it. And we're like, no, it's fine.
Yep. I stopped making my prototypes pretty for that reason. But sometimes it's funny because then they're like, oh, wait, I see the vision now. And it's like, God damn, it's a double-edged sword.
Yeah, exactly.
So annoying.
Yeah.
But back then, I feel like when I first started designing, everyone was like, oh, they're going to be skinny. Don't spend all that time on art. And now I'm noticing more and more that publishers are like, oh my God, there's art already on this. Like, let's go. Can I sign the art too?
Yeah. Well, especially with like the smaller to medium. I mean, I also think that there's a lot more publishers now. And I think especially the smaller publishers are like, Ooh, I don't have to get an artist? Yeah.
Yeah, it's like, any way to save time and money? Let's go. Like, please, I'll pump up that percentage for your royalties.
Yeah, definitely.
So how long do you think it took from that initial design contest to it coming out and being published where people could play it?
I think just under 2 years. I think it was, so we made it in, I think it was August of 2013. The Kickstarter was in February or March of 2015. So it was like a year and a half. And then Brad tried to get it, I think we had it for sale at Gen Con. So I want to say like exactly 2 years. I was like August. If I'm not remembering correctly, please don't roast me, internet. I'm sorry.
Don't worry. This is not the show that you're going to get roasted on. But I mean, that's a good timeline. I feel like around 2 years tends to be the norm for thinking up and actually having art and having it produced. So,
and playtest. I mean, I think the thing that takes the longest is playtesting and iterating. We had some friends who make video games, and they were like, "Hey, we want to make a board game with you." And we were like, "Cool, let's have like an initial like kickoff meeting. We can talk about ideas and stuff." And they were just like, "Yeah, we think that we can make this and have it for sale in 6 months." And we were like, "Absolutely not." And it was complicated. I mean, they wanted to make a complicated game. And we were just like, there's no planet on which this complicated of a game we come up with the idea today and it's for sale in 6 months. Like, that's just not going to happen. So yeah, I think that there was like the early iterating is so critical. And there's just no like guarantee of how long that's going to take before you can get to like the really meaty playtesting. You know what I'm talking about. Yeah.
No, I mean, I agree. The only times I've ever been able to put out a game at that kind of speed was like a party game that was all cards and it was based off of like a trend or whatever. And they needed it right then. And it's like, okay, we're going to do this real quick. But like, that's not the best way to design. And especially for heavier games, like, oh, don't do that. Party games are nice where once you have the hook, it's the content that's going to either sink it or make it succeed. So
exactly. And it's sometimes it's like, okay, now we need to come up with 1,000 cards. Like, okay, cool. That's on you. I already did the hard part.
Yeah. Hire a comedian.
That's good. I love that.
I mean, it's a thing. I mean, Grant Lyon has actually written content for, I think, 2 of my games that I designed.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was like the first time I met him. I found out he was talking about this like music game. I was like, wait, are you talking about Versus? And he's like, yeah, man, it's this great game. And I was like, yeah, I designed it. And he's like, no way. And I was like, yeah, you got hired to work on that. And he's like, oh, I like it. And I was like, cool. This is great. Let's be friends.
Yeah, high five. Start yeah, a beautiful friendship.
So good. So good. And the poor man still has me as a friend. Sucker. That's so cool, though, that you got to work on this game and like kind of make a cool box that people are ripping off in the future or being inspired by, whatever direction you want to market that.
Yeah, I loved it. I really loved making this one. And I felt like it was like, I felt like it was like our baby. We had a wild time with that. We went to IndieCade with that game. And IndieCade also invited us to go to E3. So we were like a board game on the floor at E3. And I was like, this is one of the weirdest experiences of my life. That was really strange.
I was going to say, so this is a board game / RPG podcast. I would love for you to explain what both of those are for those of us that do not know. I only know one of them. So that's partially me wanting to know.
Yeah, E3 was, rest in peace, it's gone now. E3 was like one of the biggest, God, I don't even want to say it was commercial. It was definitely an industry event. It was where all the biggest companies would go to show off their upcoming video games. It was for publishers and the press. And it was definitely like a big, like, it was a huge spectacle. And so that's where all of the biggest, like, they would have press conferences. So all the major companies would have press conferences. It was in Los Angeles. And like, all the big companies would have press conferences at like local theaters and in all these fancy places. And like, when I went there as games media, it was wild. I mean, I was there and I was just like, we go to a completely free party every single night and get like where there's just free alcohol and free food. Like, how are we supposed to also write articles? And it's like, oh, you're supposed to get like slightly drunk and then write very favorable articles about the companies throwing these parties, obviously.
Love the bribery.
E3 is huge. And just to give you an idea of like, I don't even want to say the prestige of it, but like, I remember the first time I went, I was walking around and it was packed. I mean, it was like shoulder to shoulder. And I was like, why does that guy up there have like a big circle of space around him? And I was like, oh, it's Steven Seagal. And those are his bodyguards. So that was like a very weird moment for me. Yeah. And then IndieCade, on the total opposite end of the spectrum, IndieCade is a small event. It also happens in around LA, usually at like in like Culver City, and it's like a small sort of art focused event. So it's very much like more serious games. So it's like more serious video games. They've got into doing tabletop a few years ago. Experiential games are also really big. Every time they have their festival, one of the nights of the festival, they just have night games, and it's just all games that are, like, I remember playing one game where you were trying to find, there were zombies, and you could turn other people into zombies, and you had to find, like, keys, but it was all, like, live action, so you're, like, running around. This was, like, in a museum in New York City. But they also have just, like, you know, some of the games are really serious and poignant and have, like, political agendas and stuff like that. So it's, like, it's definitely, like, a prestigious event. And that one, they often have space at E3. So that was, like, an overlap of both together, where it was a bunch of us just in this giant booth at E3. Like, there was one woman who made this amazing, I want to say that it was sort of like an escape room, but it had a narrative. So it was like a girl's bedroom, and there was a whole narrative in it, and the whole thing was interactive. So it was like a miniature escape room that she would just, like, when she was in festivals, she would just pack it up and put it in her car and bring it with her, and then she'd have to, like, build the whole thing on the floor. It was incredible.
So interesting. And did you pick to go there, or did they invite you to go there with a, like, a board game or a card game?
We applied to Indiecade, but we weren't expecting to get in to the E3 portion of it. We just applied. We, like, did the early application. When we first made Resistor, we applied to everything we possibly could. That's how we got into Indie Mega Booth. That was when Indie Mega Booth had first started doing board games. Indie Mega Booth, it's a company, and they would basically, like, rent out a huge space at PAX East and PAX West, and then they would have people apply. So it would be, like, a curated section of indie games, and it was, like, video games, and they had, like, a smaller section for board games. So they'd have, like, I think they'd have, like, they'd max out the board game area at, like, 10 board games.
So it's kind of like what Night Moves does at a few of these conventions.
Yeah, similar to that. Yeah.
No, that's awesome. Yeah, I mean, I didn't even know about the hobby back in 2015, to be completely honest. So some of this predates my designing, which is why I'm so curious what some of these acronyms are.
No, yeah, the sad thing is that, like, Indie Mega Booth isn't around anymore. I think Indiecade has pivoted to fully online. Like, the pandemic really wiped out a lot of these things. Like, E3, I think shuttered their doors, like, 2 or 3 years ago. But, you know, other things are kind of, you know, stepping into their place. Like, GDC now has, like, Day of the Devs, which is, like, a big celebration of indie games. And those are video games. And there are tons and tons of board game events now, which is incredible. I love seeing more and more of them pop up.
Oh my god, yeah, there's so many. I used to be like, oh yeah, convention season, I'm like, that's all year. It's literally all year. Minus, like, Christmas and New Year's. It's about it. Like,
yeah, I feel like late December and early January.
Yeah, your one minor break. And from, like, your whole experience, did you have, like, a favorite moment and a least favorite moment?
Oh my gosh, there were so many. I loved Resistor so much. I think probably one of my favorite moments for Resistor was we had to make a video, and that was one of the most difficult things for the entire Kickstarter, was making the video. And Matt Fantastic, who we had recently met, was like, I'll make your video. You're coming to New York Toy Fair, right? And we were. Our friend who owned a board game store, he was just like, hey, I'll just get you tickets. And we were like, what?
Oh, damn, that is not a cheap show to go to, so that's awesome.
Yeah, we were stoked to go. He was like, I've got some extra tickets, and we were like, yeah, we'll check it out. And, like, we didn't really have, like, any idea what we wanted our video to be like, and we got there, and when I tell you, you can see it in the video and in the pictures of me, I look like I'm high on toys. Like, I look like I just had so much sugar.
Yeah.
Like I look like an 8-year-old who just went to, like, a toy store for the first time in my life. Like, I had never seen so many, like, Funko Pops in one place, and I was just like, oh my god, Grumpy Cat is here. Like, it was so it was such a wild ride. And Matt took the video, and I mean, it was not, we could not use it for our video, but we did put it on the Kickstarter page, and I was just like, I have so much affection for that video. It's so sweet. Low point, one of my least favorite things is that, like, a very small handful of people on BGG were like, I can't sleeve my cards. And I was like, I don't care. Because they were like, I don't want to buy your game because I can't sleeve my cards. And I was like, okay.
They weren't, like, standard sizes, like US or...
They were tarot-sized cards. Okay. But the box was... You couldn't... Like, the box... You had to use that box sleeve to draw the cards. And, like, our friend Joe Kim, who worked at Card Kingdoms at the time, handmade his own box four Moxes because he was just like, we sleeve all of our cards.
I was going to say, you could just use an X-Acto knife. Like,
you could just make a new box. And one of these guys tracked me down at BGG Con to tell me that he was the guy from BGG who told me he wanted to sleeve the cards. And I was like, I'm literally working. I can't tell you what I really want to tell you. So yeah, that was like just, and also like, I should just never go on BGG to look at game ratings ever of my own games. Cause it was like, somebody went on BGG and they said, I like this game, but I would like it better if it was Train Barons. And it was when there were a bunch of train games out. And I was just like, why do I ever look on the internet? I just shouldn't do this. I should just leave society. Like,
oh no, let's not go that far. Yeah. I mean, hot take, I rarely look at my own like BGG comments for my games because I started to back with Her Story and I got depressed and sad. So I stopped doing it because there was a lot of people making comments about like, why a game about women? Like, oh, this game is only for women and some less fun, nice things.
What about a game about men called His Story? You mean like all of history?
Oh, I also heard that joke a lot of times. Yeah. I was just like, oh, this makes me like kind of hate the world.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Like, we'll build our own cabin in the woods. No internet.
That sounds super cozy. Let's go. Yeah, no. Oh my gosh. I remember when I was working on Her Story, there was like one Amazon review in particular that just like blew my mind. I was like, there's no way this is a real person. And I was like, oh, but you know, like Amazon, when you purchase something, like in order to put a review, it'll say like they had purchased the thing. And I was like, oh my God, this person actually purchased the game, but like, did they play it at all? Completely blew my freaking mind. But I'm actually like pulling it up as I'm talking. So I'm going to read this because this is just like it. I keep it because it makes me laugh a little bit. So I get 1 out of 5 stars. Bolded, we have woke garbage. I don't pee sitting down.
Ugh.
And then unbolded, this is a game only Karens will enjoy. I'm not a Karen. I'm a man and proud of my superiority. Pass on this game and play Twister instead. It is much more fun lathered in coconut oil with a hot babe.
Ew.
I know. I mean, we of course got it taken down, but this was like December 18, 2022.
Ugh.
Oh, fucking fantastic. Oh my God. Whoa. And I was like, yeah. It was very cringe, but reasons I don't read my reviews all that often anymore.
Yeah, I don't blame you. I also avoid them completely. I hate that for you.
Oh, yeah. Well, I hate it for women in general. More than just me. Oh my gosh. Yeah. Past that touchy subject, do you have any advice from when you were working on Resistor or even now? Because it's been quite some time and, I mean, you're working for Kickstarter, so maybe you have some advice in that direction beyond just designing.
Yeah, I mean, part of what I tell people when they're designing is that, like, one of the best things they can do is go to playtesting events. Back before 2020, that was a real privilege, you know, getting to go to something like Unpub or Protospiel or Metatopia. That was like, you had to live near one of those places or be able to take off the time and travel. And then when 2020 hit, all of those places pivoted to online. And also like a lot of groups like Break My Game started using Discord and, you know, things like Tabletopia. So it's become, the barrier to entry on playtesting has gotten a lot lower. And it's not just like what I try to explain to creators, especially new creators, is it isn't just about playtesting and getting feedback on your games. It's about meeting other people in the industry. It's about networking because you are going to find fans of your game and your work and you in places that you never would have imagined. Like, we made our prototypes on the Game Crafter, and back in 2013, 2014, it was a lot more limited than it is now. Anthony would often go on, I don't know if they still have this, but Game Crafter used to have, just in the bottom right corner, there was just a little chat option, and you could just chat to anyone else who was logged in and online on the Game Crafter. So it was just like a little party where you could just talk to anybody who was online at the time. And Anthony went in and asked a bunch of questions about box sizes and card sizes. And like, we went to like a Game Crafter meetup at Gen Con. We met a bunch of these people in person, and some of them are like still our friends to this day. And like, the day that we launched the Kickstarter, we launched it and the site went down for like 5 minutes. It was so funny because in that chat, people were like, what's going on? I logged in early just to back Resistor. Why isn't it? And we were like, oh my God, I was so touched.
That's so
like,
sweet.
It was so sweet. I cried. I mean, I cried a lot that month, but like, I'll never forget like how touched I was and how sweet it was. And that's why I say like, you know, you should be going to these events. And if you can't get to these events, you should be, you know, making friends with people online at these, on some of these online groups, because these are going to be the people that are going to be like the real fans of your game. And they're going to, you know, they're going to be your cheerleaders. And it's really awesome to meet them. Like some of my closest friends that I have in my life are people that I met, you know, doing all of this. And it's just, you know, it changed my life for the better. And I'm really happy for it.
No, I completely agree. I feel like when I first started, because I lived in the Chicago area, so there was a ton of like Protospiels that were driving distance, like the Chicago's, Indianapolis's, Minnesota had one in Minneapolis, and then there was other ones. There was just like a ton within driving distance, and then just a ton of like local groups. And I feel like I became a much faster, better designer quicker because I had access to so many different people that I could like plug their brain, get really great feedback, see how they prototype things, get tips from them on how to like be more efficient in my prototyping. So I feel like it kind of leveled me up a little bit faster. Like I got put on the like walking path that's like electronic and it lets me go a little quicker. Which was really nice because like now I live kind of on an island, I joke, because I moved and there's no like game design groups nearby. It's like I mostly see people at conventions or I have to like relocate my body to another place that has other designers or game enthusiasts in order to find playtesters. But it's also kind of nice because like most of the games I make are for the casual gamer or the non-gamer. So I just kind of grab random people I find at like my rock climbing gym to play games or at a brewery or whatever. So.
Oh, that's awesome. That's perfect.
Yeah. I mean, I learned to like change how I did things, but I will say I very much miss having those communities around. I think they're a great way, especially for a newer designer to like build those connections.
I love that. Yeah. I mean, we were in Philly, so we had like, we were like 2 hours from Baltimore for Unpub, and we were like, you know, we weren't too far from Boston. So we ended up like going to Boston FIG, which is the Boston Festival of Indie Games. And that's how I also used to go to Boston Game Loop, which is like a video game. Oh God. It's like an unconference. So everybody shows up in the morning and instead of having like a set conference with all of the subjects, like decided out beforehand and scheduled beforehand, everybody talks about what they want to learn. And then people say like, oh, I could teach that. And then like, basically you just make like a huge list of all the things that people want to learn. And then you find people who would be willing to like teach them. And then everybody votes with stickers. And then the people who run it basically take like half an hour to set the schedule.
Oh, that's cool.
It is so fucking rad that we ended up bringing it to Philadelphia, and we ran it in Philadelphia like 4 times because we were like, we also want to do this in Philly, and we loved it. And that we also brought the Game Makers Guild from Boston to Philly, which I think is hilarious because we were like, you know, we need, because what ended up happening with Dev Night was Dev Night for the most part was people who worked in the video game industry as their day jobs, or they did it like in their, you know, spare time. So that like every Thursday night they wanted to like come and have a couple beers and play some couch co-op games. And so we were like, oh no, now that we make board games, we need a dedicated like group that we can play test with. So we started Game Makers Guild Philadelphia as like 8 people in like a basement of a board game store. And like that has turned into like a pretty big group. And like, you know, but it was just, we just needed more people to purchase it. But I mean, you saying that you felt like you had access to people. I mean, we were so close to New York that when we would go to Unpubs in Westchester, Pennsylvania, Gil Hova would often come. And like, what a boon that was, because he was the first person who ever said to me when I was playtesting one of my own personal prototypes that I made myself, he was like, hey, I think we've all played enough and we're all ready to give you feedback. And it was so, but he said it in such a nice way. He didn't say it like, hey, this game sucks and we're ready to tell you. He was like, hey, so I think we've played a few rounds and we kind of understand where you're going, and I don't think that it's gonna, I think that we should, like, he was very politely saying like, this needs to be fixed and we're gonna help you do that. And it was just so, it was so kind.
Man, honestly, I super respect when people are able to do that, because often I will be reviewing a game for like Wise Wizard and I'm just like dying on the inside. I was like, ugh, how do I kindly say this needs to end and give feedback?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, and I think I've also talked to a lot of people about how to give and accept feedback, because a lot of people are like, well, how do I take like negative feedback? And I'm like,
you write it down.
You write
thank
it.
Thank you.
100%. You temporarily don't pay attention to your ego and you say, thank you very much. I have written down that note and I will. You know what I mean? Like there are very few times when I tell people that they should be in any way confrontational. Like if you said to a group, like we had a situation where we were playtesting an expansion for Laser Riders, and we sat down and we said, hey, this is an expansion for Laser Riders. We would like feedback on the expansion stuff. We told them the expansion stuff, and at the end of the playtest, this guy was like, I think you should get rid of the dice. And I was like, cool, that's a part of the published game.
That stinks.
We're not going to get rid of the dice. Yeah, and he just kept pushing like all these other things that he thinks. And I was like, hey, I appreciate your ideas. I would like to get feedback on the expansion, and then we can revisit whatever you want to say, you know? But I really did want to walk into the ocean with that one.
It's so funny. That like made me flash back to my first proto spiel I ever went to was in Indianapolis, and I met Randy Eckel, who's a game designer. And I was playtesting my game Curbside, and I had forgot my notebook like in the hotel room. And so I had been using my phone, and he's like, are you not going to write things down? I was like, oh, I forgot my notebook I brought. And he's like, are you kidding? And I was like, I am not kidding. It is in the room. And then he like pulls out like an extra pad. He's like, you need to write it down. Being on your phone just makes it seem like you're not paying attention to the person. And I was like, okay. And it was funny because I like turned it around to show him the like little note thing. And I was like, oh, after that, I feel like I'm at this point where I just always have my journal. Like I always have a game design journal. It's got all the little stickers on it, but no one can ever accuse me of anything because I try really hard not to forget it.
Well, that's also why, I mean, I often take notes on my phone, and when I'm, you know, especially if I'm like meeting with people for Kickstarter,
I can't escape.
I'll immediately say like, hey, do you mind if I take some notes on my phone? Because I don't want them to think that I'm like,
yep, I say it ahead of time.
I used to, here's a great trick. When I was doing video game journalism, I had a smart pen, and it was called, the company was called like LiveScribe, and it was a pen that recorded audio, but it also had special paper. So if you were interviewing someone and they were talking about like, oh, like this is what we're going to have in our trailer, and you wanted to remember that part of the interview, you could write down the word trailer on the piece of paper. And then when you uploaded the audio and the piece of paper, if you clicked on the word trailer, it would take you to that part of the interview.
Oh, that's so cool.
It was so cool. And it was the best icebreaker ever, because I would be like, hey, do you mind if I record you? And they would be like, is that a pen? And I'd be like, yes. And then I would explain to them how the pen worked. And they would be like, oh my God, are you a spy? And
I'd
be like,
I was going to say, secret agent. Knew it.
Yeah. But it's very cool. It's very cool. And I wonder if that'll ever like become popular in like board game playtesting, because it's so like cool and futuristic. I wish those things had, they've never like gained popularity, and they were so dope.
Yeah, I was going to say, I feel like I would use something like that. That sounds awesome. At least for like my meetings I have to take for Wise Wizard, that would be very, very useful.
Yeah, because then you can like go back and listen to them again. And like, again, great icebreaker, because by the time you get through like how the pen works, you're like, okay, sweet, we're best friends. Now let's have an interview, or now let's have a meeting, you know?
Yeah, totally makes sense. Do you have any other games that like people should be looking out for, by the way?
Resistor, I believe, is out of print. Laser Riders might be out of print. Centipede, I'm pretty sure, is out of print. We also did a postcard game for Button Shy, which I think was one of the like board game of the month club that he does for his Patreon. But we do, before Anthony passed away, we signed a game with Smirk and Dagger called Boom Patrol, and that kickstarted over the summer. So that one is one to look out for. And yeah, Anthony and I had a lot of prototypes. That was the last one that we got signed. We have some other ones that I just haven't been able to, like get back into the swing of like talking to publishers. And as you can tell, I'm also like, don't remember how some of the games even work. So I'm like, oh man, I would have to like go through the sell sheets to find all of the documentation. But yeah, and I also have some games. I've been working on some RPGs, which has been really fun. I did some work for Wet Ink. I did one of the adventures for Never Going Home, and I worked on the items for Garbage and Glory. Yeah, and I'm working on a game with Ninth Level Games called Wrestlevania Symphony of the Fight.
Okay.
Which is hysterical. It's like a wrestling roguelike tabletop RPG, which is very funny. Yeah, and I've got Josh and I are working on a game. And I've got some games that, one of the things about working with Anthony was very spatially, like, I'm spatially challenged. So Anthony was the one who, like, made most of our prototypes. And I came up with this game idea once, and he was like, cool, well, why don't you just make it? And I was like, I hate this. And I found, like, a bunch of clip art online and, like, made all the cards and, like, printed all out. And I was like, okay, I made it. And he was like, sweet, let's play it. And it sucked. And then we worked on it. We worked on it more, we got it to a playable state, and it was really fun. But, like, he also was just, like, you know, there was another game that I had an idea for, and I tried to explain it to him. And he was like, yeah, but where's the game? And I was like, I just told you. And he was like, no, but, like, how do you play it? And I was like, no, I told you that part, too. And then I, like, finally, like, sat down and, like, made a whole prototype. And I was like, okay, so then, like, this is how it works. And, like, you do this, and the other player does that. And he was like, see, was that hard? And I was like, was that supposed to be a lesson? Because I hated it.
What are these Jedi mind tricks you're doing?
Yeah, I hated it so much. So, yeah, I think that I need, I definitely need some more practice with prototyping. And, I want to learn things like Nandek and stuff like that. You asked me a question, I got way off topic, but yeah.
No, you did all the thing. That was stuff people should look out for, yeah. You more than answered the question. Well, here, for my last question, completely unrelated to everything we've already talked about. If you could have been the designer of a game that you didn't design, which one do you wish it was?
I have so many games that I'm like, oh, I'm so mad. Like, I wish I had just made this game. Because I'm like, oh, this game is so... It reminds me of this meme I saw that was like, you know, modern art equals, I could have done that plus, but you didn't.
Yep.
Our favorite, the first one that Anthony and I really loved was definitely Pandemic. And so, like, I don't know. Ah, gosh. Then we start talking about Quacks of Quedlinburg, you know? And that's... I mean, Quacks... Oh, God. I wish I had made Quacks. What a brilliantly thinky... Irritating. I think it'd be Quacks, and I think the only thing that I would change is they would all be ducks.
Okay.
So duck doctors, because everybody, you know, the biggest complaint I hear from people are like, you know, you pull the game out and they're like, wait, it's not ducks? And I'm like, if I had a nickel for how many times I heard that, and if I had made this game with ducks, I have so many nickels. I'd be loaded.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think you'd have more than some nickels if you didn't want to make it. Oh my God. Okay. That was a great answer. I love that answer.
Thank you.
Oh my gosh. And for everyone who's been listening to this episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication, episode 113, Resistor, this has been Nicole and me, Danielle. But Nicole, where can you be found online if people are trying to find your designs or whatever you got coming up?
Oh man. So I'm also such a complicated question in today's nightmare landscape. I am Toits on Twitter, TOITS. I'm Geek with Tan Lines on Instagram. I don't really have like an updated website. You can find me, if you want to find my early games, I'm under my maiden name, which is Nicole Klein on Board Game Geek. And then they made a separate, I say they, like it's some like unknown, I don't know who, someone made a Nicole Amato entry on Board Game Geek. So I actually have two entries, and I often wonder if I can connect them somehow. But if you ever want to, yeah, if you want to see what I'm doing, I guess Board Game Geek is the best place to look, because CardboardFortressGames.com is not updated at all.
That's interesting. I'm sure like you could probably ask them to combine those, but...
I know. As I was saying it, I was like, You know,
this could be something to do when we stop talking.
Be right back, sending one email.
Yeah, that's fair. Oh my God. And I'm your host, Danielle Reynolds. If you're looking to find me on social media, you can check out my Instagram, Twitter, and Blue Sky under the username Token Gamer. And that's GAYMER. You can also find me under BGG, under Danielle Reynolds, or my website, dmrcreativegroup.com. So yeah, find both of us. And I hope you guys enjoy this episode. Thanks for being on the show, Nicole.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining Danielle for another episode of Game Design Unboxed, Inspiration to Publication. If you'd like to hear more great gaming podcasts, check out nodirectionpodcasts.com. And if you're looking for a great board game, bag, playmat, or table, check out AllPlay at letsallplay.com. Join us next time.